Hello and welcome to the Ad Fontes podcast. My name is Ansi Kamel. I am an editor at large at the journal Ad Fontes, and I'm joined as always, and it's been quite some time, but joined once again by my two co-hosts, Colin Chan Redimer, the poetry editor at Ad Fontes, and Reese Laverty, the senior editor of the whole operation. Gentlemen, it's great to be here with you.
It's good to be back.
Mm-hmm. I mean, last time we recorded, was the last time we recorded anything together? We were actually in person, so it's a little bit bittersweet. Colin and I recorded one with Joe since then. That was it. But always good to be here.
Yeah. Good to be back. Colin has the perpetual smirk affixed to his face, which our listeners can't see, but I have no idea what he's going to have, why he's smirking. It comes out in his voice. That's right. But anyway, so today we're really excited because we're starting a series on the newest book published by the Davenant Press, Begotten or Made by Oliver O'Donovan. O'Donovan is probably, I think it's not an overstatement to say, the greatest living theological ethicist. And we published a second edition of his book, which was originally published in the 80s by Oxford University Press. Oxford was, you know, I won't say anything, but we thought it could have, you know, an updated, some updates, you know, for an American audience and a second edition. So we acquired the rights from Oxford Press, and we just wanted to start a series on this book because honestly, it I think alongside Jacques Ellul's The Technological Society, to me, is just one of the great works of Protestant moral theology on a kind of practical topic. I mean, I was reading O'Donovan and I thought to myself, man, you know, Protestants don't have any right to be this good. You know, I mean, this is the sort of thing that like people think only Catholics can do. And then you like read Protestants doing it and it's fantastic. But anyway, so that's what we're going to be talking about. Colin, I'll kick it to you first to kind of introduce how we're going to be doing this series. And then we should go to Reese because Reese was an editor, for the book. So Colin.
Yeah, the idea behind this is going to be a series of podcasts. And if you aren't reading the book, I think there should still be plenty of content here that will be interesting to you. And if you are, if you have the book, or if you don't have it and you want to buy it and read along with us, you know, each chapter is something like, you know, 10 to 20 pages. So they're very short. But the problem with reading O'Donovan, it's actually much like reading C.S. Lewis. It's not really a problem. It's a joy. His writing is very clear. It's very fast paced. And I think anyone who's, you know, even just kind of moderately college educated, you don't even necessarily need to be a college graduate. Anybody who's made it into college can read this and understand his broader point that he's making in each chapter. But much like C.S. Lewis, there's so many references and so many classical distinctions, so many sources, such a deep tradition of thought that's present in just about every sentence that it doesn't, you know, you can get a PhD under Oliver O'Donovan and go back and read this book and see new things each time you're reading it. And so the idea behind the series was let's read through it and just stop whenever we think that there's a question, either something that we're learning or remembering as we're reading it, or the kind of question that we think the average college-educated reader of this is might be asking or might have, that O'Donovan is sort of presuming you already have answered this question because you've already read, you know, your Plato, your Aristotle, your Augustine, your Aquinas, your literally everything in the Western tradition, and probably a lot of other things as well. We are not Oliver O'Donovan's. That's the first caveat to this. But we are the people that Oliver O'Donovan entrusted to edit the second edition of his work. And we have one of them right here, which is Reese Laverty. So that's the project that we're going to go through. It'll take us one chapter each week. We're going to be doing the first chapter today, which is called Medicine and the Liberal Revolution. Reese, so he's talking about the libs, right? The Democrats, right? As the editor.
Yeah, he wants to own them, definitely. 40 years before anybody else did. That's chapter one. And to say as well, there's a new introduction that Matthew Lee Anderson wrote, friend of the show, And a preface as well, original to O'Donovan's first edition that's included before you get to chapter one. But we thought we'd kick off kind of where the action really begins.
Maybe we'll get back to that, but you know, we got to get to the meat and potatoes first.
Yeah, exactly. So medicine and the liberal revolution. He unpacks what he means by liberal later on, and suffice to say, it is not as simple as what we would now call the libs, or what one may call the libs. You know, maybe we don't use that terminology on this show. I'll just read the first few lines, and then I'll sort of kick it on to help us, like Colin said, unpack some of the kind of categories in there that you may miss if you're not familiar with O'Donovan's thought world. So from the start of chapter one, when the fathers of the Council of Nicaea declared in words familiar to every Christian who recites their creed that the only Son of God the Father was begotten, not made, they intended to make a simple point. The Son was of one being with the Father. He was God, just as God the Father was God. And to emphasize the point, they used an analogy based upon our twofold human experience of forming things other than ourselves. That which we beget is like ourselves. I shall use the word beget as the ancients did to speak of the whole human activity of procreation, and not in the modern way, meaning especially the male side of the activity. Our offspring are human beings who share with us one common human nature, one common human experience, and one common human destiny. I'll stop there. Off the bat, you get where the titles come from. He's taking a line from the Nicene Creed that the Son, Jesus Christ, is begotten, not made. And that is where he begins to take his cue from. But he says that every Christian who recites their creed, not that many Christians recite their creeds these days. And even the place in scripture where one would have most historically encountered that use of a word begotten in John 1, you know, God's only begotten Son, actually in our modern translations, that word tends to actually be excised. So the idea, even the language of being begotten, is quite foreign to a lot of us.
This is news to me. What do they say in the modern translations now?
Just his one and only Son, I think, is the
NIV. Yeah, one and only is the... They argue that only begotten. I don't know exactly what the textual arguments are. I mean, it's monogenos in Greek, but I think the word the worry is that there's a temptation to sort of read later metaphysical stuff back into scripture But I mean, monogenos, only begotten. It's clearly, you know, it's
the only like, originating. Yeah.
Right. Well, there is an essay on that very point in a great book, Retrieving Eternal Generation. I had it on my desk here because I was looking at it earlier. I can't remember who writes the chapter in it about John 1 and monogenes. But yes, anywho, so this idea of begetting and its contrast from making is something that makes its way into the creed and is quite key to some of the early kind of debates about the person of Christ. So, you know, we are going to get to the ethics and stuff, but this is where O'Donovan takes it from. So I'll kick it to Onsi to talk about one of his fellow countrymen. And the great work that he did in thrashing this
one out. Of my ancestors, one of my forebears, Saint Athanasius. But I think, you know, to Colin's point, O'Donovan is very dense, and he sort of layers in lots of stuff from the tradition, particularly in works that are aimed at a more general audience like this. He layers in tons of stuff from the tradition that he doesn't really tell you he's doing. He just sort of, he gestures at it and then just sort of recapitulates what the tradition has said. So in the case of being begotten, he says, you know, as the councils in the early church said, you know, this is like, and then he gives you kind of how begottenness is functioning for them. And this, I think, the distinction between being begotten and being made is absolutely central to his book. And I think it's actually central to the Christian tradition. And O'Donovan, I mean, it's I was kind of marveling to myself as I read this again. I read this book for the first time several years ago, before I'd done much study in theology. I think it was an undergraduate in college. And this distinction which O'Donovan makes, just reading it again, it's extraordinary to me that he picks up exactly the place in the Christian tradition where this distinction is most carefully articulated and crucially articulated, and then applies it to medical ethics, like in the 20th century. I mean, it's really just remarkable to me that he can do this. But anyway, okay, so what's the distinction? So O'Donovan points us to the early debates about Christ's incarnation and the Trinity as a locus for thinking about what it means to be begotten as opposed to what it is to being made. And so, you know, the debates with the Aryans loom large here. And so I wanted to
which
to
is
take
the
a brief...
followers of Arius, who was an early heretic, and the Arian heresy being
right, that Christ is the first creature of the Father. I mean, there were varieties of this, but essentially that Christ is not of one substance with the Father, that he's somehow lower than the Father according to his nature. So he's created
he's
by
the first
Father.
Creature.
He's the first creature of the Father, these sorts of things. But so Athanasius, I just wanted to kind of take us back to Athanasius, who kind of I won't say that he originates this distinction, but he sort of like makes it the crucial distinction, I think, in these early debates. And so in his De Decretis, Athanasius, on the basis of scripture, he says when he's talking about what it means for Christ to be a son, so he has to oppose the Arian interpretation of sonship, which is to say that Christ is the, you know, a creature of the Father, you know, created by the Father's will. And Athanasius says on the basis of scripture, there are two possible meanings of the word son. So notice there, he points to scripture and says, let's look at how scripture uses these terms. So on the basis of scripture, there are two meanings for the word son. Those who, and this is a quote, gain the name by grace from moral improvement. So the people who are particularly pious or virtuous are called sons of God in scripture. And then the second sense is the sense of natural generation. And he says, so sexual reproduction and begetting. And so he holds the word son to obtain of Christ, the second person of the Trinity, in the second sense, in the sense of natural generation. And this is what he says. The son is, quote, naturally begotten and does not accrue to him from without. So that's, I think, the key distinction, right? So the son is naturally begotten and he's not generated. He's not brought into being. There's nothing that's given to him. He's not fashioned from outside, as it were. And I think in this passage from De Decretis, it's book 3, chapter 6, and then chapter 10, we kind of see the germs of this distinction that O'Donovan makes right at the beginning. To be begotten is to be produced naturally from another that is like yourself. To be made, by contrast, is to be fashioned from without. So when humans beget humans, we beget creatures who are like ourselves. My daughter, my son, are like me. They share the same nature as I have. They have a kind of equal standing to me. I didn't sort of manipulate them into being. They sort of arose out of a marriage, right? They just—that's just sort of the way that God has ordered nature to work. So they, and because I haven't sort of worked on them in the sense that I might work on a table that I'm building, I stand in a different sort of relationship to them, right? I don't; they're not products of my will. So, Colin, you want to jump in here? I've been rambling.
So that's like that's a good distinction. And so, like, you know, my kids are begotten. The table that I build, assuming I could build a table, is made. But some things seem to be both begotten and made, and this is where things I think get a little tricky because, you know, for example, he says, "My son is begotten of me," right? A human is begotten of its parents, but it is made by God. Every human is made by God.
Yes.
And so in the same sense, there are other things we can think of that have that kind of dual relationship, which makes it a little bit tricky and maybe hard to think through. Like my Basset Hound, all Basset Hounds are begotten of Basset Hounds, which are, you know, begotten of wolves at some point. They're also made by humans, right? There's a fashioning of the Basset Hound that humans have sort of partaken in. And I don't know if doesn't that complicate the categories? Because where he's going to head with this is we have to then ask this question about humanity. Is it begotten? Is it made? Can it be a little bit of both? And if it is, in relative to what? Reese?
Well, so he introduces later the what sounds like a weak idea at first, the idea of appropriateness. And medical technology and where it is appropriate or inappropriate for it to kind of intrude or be deployed with regards to human persons. So just to kind of take that example of, say, breeding animals, where they're, you know, every Basset Hound is begotten of a Basset Hound, but made by, you know, the arch-experienced Basset Hound breeder who has crafted such an evolutionary marvel as the Basset Hound. My gut response as you were saying that is to say, well, it is appropriate, I think, maybe not to breed Basset Hounds. They're just bred for leisure. It's appropriate to say breed good livestock, whatever. And for technology, say artificial insemination, most bulls are kind of, their semen is taken to artificially inseminate female cows. That is appropriate. Whereas to intervene in similar or even the same ways in human reproduction or other stuff. And we should say, I don't think we mentioned actually, sorry, this book was initially written in response to a report and commission under the Margaret Thatcher government on IVF. So that is the immediate medical question in view, in vitro fertilization. Yeah, so test tube babies, creating children outside of the womb with an egg and sperm, implanting them, and a kind of attendant issues to that. That's the most immediate thing, but he does kind of speak to other stuff as well throughout the course of the book. So medical, that kind of medical intervention, it feels to me, you can say it's appropriate when it comes to animals, but not appropriate when it comes to human beings. Now, there's some assumptions baked in there. I believe that human beings are fundamentally different to all the other animals. But that's my initial response, that yes, everything is going to be, so there are some things that are going to be a kind of mixture of begetting and making, and that's when you need later things that O'Donovan introduces.
But yeah, I think it's important, to say that, two contraries, I mean, this is like a sort of standard philosophical principle, contraries cannot both be true of the same thing at the same time in the same respect. Okay, so when O'Donovan...
Work us through that relative to this.
Yeah. So contraries cannot be true of the same thing at the same time in the same respect. So basically, I mean, in a very simple case, you can't be short and tall simultaneously. Mm-hmm. You can't be skinny and fat simultaneously. It is possible to be both skinny and fat, but
relative
not at the same time.
Or relative
to different things.
Yeah.
So you might have, Colin is not sort of fat in the sense that he's overweight, but he's got some pretty fat biceps. He's been in the gym working out.
I'm a thick guy.
Yeah, he's a big dude. But that's one example. So in this context, the reason it's important is because when O'Donovan says that humans are made, we are made by God. We don't make one another. We beget one another. God makes us. And this is crucial because what he says, and this is a really striking point that I need to give more reflection to, but he says that anything that is made obeys the will of its maker as its law. And there's so much packed into that. So anything that's made obeys the will of its maker as its law. And basically, so we can think about this in terms of if you make a watch, right? The sort of the watch, if it's well made, so we're talking like Swiss watch here. We're not talking I don't know what a bad watch is, but
not a watch that a man offers you, which is hanging on the inside of his trench coat.
That's right. On the street, on the inside of his coat.
On a sundial.
Yeah.
That's right. Obscure reference to Disney's Hercules there, if anybody's listening.
But a good watch is will sort of design the way that it's been, or will function the way that it's been designed to function, right? And so what O'Donovan wants to say is that that humans are a product of God's will, and so God's will is our law. We are obligated to function the way that God has sort of willed us to function in creating us. The same thing is not true of fellow human beings. I am not the law of my daughter's existence. And if I were, or if I thought that I were, there would be some, we would have a very disordered sort of
right, you guys share a law,
a common law that's existence. Given to us by God, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Reese.
Yeah, well, I think that's if anyone is reading along that point, so top of page 3 in our edition, I think Nancy mentioned about the law of its being, and straight after that he says to speak of begetting is to speak of quite another possibility than this, the possibility that one may form another being who will share one's own nature and with whom one will enjoy a fellowship based on radical equality. Now. Mm-hmm. radical is usually a weasel word when people use it. It's one of those words that Aunt C, I think, has mentioned before. You know, it's usually just kind of trying to carry water and make what you've said sound really profound. When actually, like, it's like, well, what does radical mean in this sentence? But I think here it's just.
And that was really radical of Aunt C to say.
Yeah.
That was. I'm a radically. I don't even know what the word would be. But anyway, all right.
Yeah. Continue. Anyway, so radical comes from radix, same as a radish. It means rooted. So it's an equality rooted in your being.
My mind. I did not know the radish to radical. Anyway, keep going. Okay, so it's rooted.
I mean, that may be right. I may have just committed an etymological fallacy. Who knows? But
Reese, that just means that you're part of the great tradition of etymological fallacy making. Christians and pagans
truly made it. Yeah. As a Christian pseudo academic. Yeah. So you know what he's saying there is, if you are begotten of the same nature, you are equal, radically so, because it's just rooted in your nature. If you are not begotten, if you're made, then there is, if O'Donovan's article tracks, necessarily an inequality between the first person, the maker, and the second person, the made. And the question I had scribbled in my margin rereading this is, well, what is the nature of that inequality? Now, this is about IVF, this is about test tube babies, of whom there are now many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, in the many, many years since O'Donovan wrote this. What is the nature of that inequality? Colin, jump in.
Yeah, I think this is answering a question that I had about page 2. He says, what we make, and make is in quotes, this is kind of at the top middle, what we make then is alien from our humanity. And, you know, I'm a bit of an artist, and, you know, it does seem like when you have this thing brewing inside of you, when you want to produce, and this is true of writers too, you're both writers, you feel this pregnancy of the mind that you want to produce this thing. And I've often said, right, it's our techne is an extension of ourselves. So there is a sort of likeness there. And it says in Genesis that God makes man in his image and likeness, right? There's a likeness there too. Mm-hmm. So I just was wondering as I read it, you know, one of the questions I can imagine an attentive reader would ask is, well, in what sense is it alien from our humanity? But I think this is kind of answering it, which is to say, what we make is obedient to us in
That's
a
right.
sense.
It answers it, to me. That's what yes, editing yeah. is.
It's not to say it doesn't like contain any of your humanity. Because mm-hmm. when we think about art, we always think about that. You know, it's the stamp of this. You can just kind of feel Rembrandt's humanity in this incredible painting mm-hmm. or whatever. Like, it's not to say that it's not, again, in the sort of the way that we relate to God, it's not participating in kind of things of Rembrandt or whatever. But it is ultimately utterly obedient to him. That's the nature of it. Yeah.
And so it's an extension or a presentation of the self. But in begetting something, in a weird way, it's almost more myself than my art is, even though it doesn't obey me. So it's simultaneously radically equal to me. It's like another me, while also being other than me in a way that art isn't.
Art isn't that kind of interesting? It's not. It's an extension of it. It's like it's another instance of your nature, but it's not another instance of your will. You know, and that's,
he makes that distinction at the top of page 2. And I just, you know, he says that the Father said the eternal Son of God was not made, was of the Father's being, not his will. So
exactly.
The distinction between being and will. Being is, you know, in the ordering of the transcendentals is pretty darn, if it's not the top, it's pretty darn close to the top. Will is not even a transcendental from the Christian right. perspective. And this is one of the things that makes us radically distinct from Islam, who you know, generally, I get me, you know, obviously more about Islam than I do at this point, Anzi, but the will of God precedes the good and the true in the ordering of their understanding of the nature of God. So God's will and his being are essentially identical. And we would say that the will, you know, proceeds from the transcendentals.
That's sort of tricky. Sorry, for
it might be it might be a sidetrack, but all this stuff rattling in my head, and I'm thinking, yeah, okay. And you can see why begetting is so important here, as distinct from making. And he makes these things in his likeness, which beget like he does, but are made by him, as art is made by us. We do both begetting and making too, just as God does. And so there's this mirroring of it, and to maybe move us into, because he talks about politics, right? The title talks about this liberal order. And you were talking about this concept of the law of God is written into our nature. And just as when I write something or, you know, if you paint a picture, you sort of, your will is a law to mm-hmm. that picture. It has to obey it. Then he moves on and talks about kind of the liberal revolution in modernity. And I think the connection that he's making is that the loss of providence as a category, he even talks about this a little bit, is a sort of forgetting about the relatedness that we have to the law which governs us. Does that sound right?
Yes.
Or if it doesn't, help me understand, because he's trying to make this connection between this theological category, which he makes into an ethical category, and then he sort of moves into this political set of categories.
Yeah, so before we get to the political set of categories and sure. him unpacking what he means by liberal, he talks about the technological. And I think it's important that we track in that order. And one of my kind of question marks in it, over the chapter, just my reflection, not I think he gets this wrong, is the kind of chicken and egg situation of technological advance and the advance of what he calls the liberal revolution, our, you know, essentially our sort of deeply changed sense of freedom to mean freedom from suffering and inconvenience rather than a freedom for the realization of our kind of given embodied humanity. So bottom of page 3 in our edition, after this stuff about inequality and begetting and making, he talks about us in a technological culture.
Yeah, and just briefly, I just wanted to point out what we've been talking about for however long we've been talking now, like 30 minutes or so, yeah. is the first 2 pages of his book. Yeah, okay? Yeah, yeah. I mean, so, like, that's how dense and wonderful this book is. Anyway, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, so we'll try and trip through the rest of the chapter kind of from here. So yeah, he talks about...
If we don't make it, we'll do 2 episodes on the first chapter. I'm fine with it. Exactly. Go ahead.
Yeah. he talks about the technological culture, drawing from George Grant and Jacques Ellul, who we've mentioned already. And what he means is by technological culture is not one where just we do lots of technological stuff and lots of technology exists and happens, but where we look at things in a technological manner. This is the bottom of page 3. It's not technological because its instruments of making are extraordinarily sophisticated, though that is evidently the case, but because it thinks of everything it does as a form of instrumental making. We are so used to making with so much technological power in our grasp that any situation that presents itself to us, we look for the technological solution. This is why we talk about technocrats kind of in the political sphere now, people who think, well, the answer is just going to be more technology. You know, global warming, well, hey, technology got us into that problem. Technology is going to get us out of it. It's a classic. If you've got a hammer, which is a technology, of course, every situation will look like a nail. So the technological society kind of becomes a thing, and then he gets into, on page 4, this question of appropriateness. And because we're a technological society, we just lose all sense of when it is appropriate for that technology to intervene, which is a Jurassic Park moment. You were so busy thinking about whether you could, you never stopped to think about whether you should. I'm rambling, so I'll hand over to someone else in a sec, but I like the appropriateness technology the appropriateness category, because it's not sort of necessarily a kind of hard ethical category. He doesn't say, we don't think about whether it's kind of right and wrong in a kind of black and white way, but it's more, it's richer than that. Yeah.
So the very, very good. And yes, of course, we got to talk about technology before we get into that. But I just saw this connection with providence, and I was jumping the gun, so I apologize for that. The stuff on bottom of 3 page, top of page 4, you know, he says it's not about how advanced your actual sort of machines are, right? The problem with is when you begin thinking technologically and you can't think in any other way. And he has this great line where he says that technological thinking causes you to lose the ability to recognize the significance of what you see. And so when I explain this to students, because this is actually something that you can find in common with thinkers who are critiquing modernity as diverse as Martin Heidegger and C.S. Lewis. They both make very similar points. If you talk to a student, you look at the Mississippi River. If all you can say about the Mississippi River is sort of how many, you know, calories of human chemical energy could you produce out of it? Or how many kilowatts of electricity could we produce if we dammed the whole thing up? Then you're missing the Mississippi River. You don't fully understand it yet. You have to actually be able to see it as a river. And a river is something more than simply energy. And that's this.
It's
this
more
kind
than
of point.
Its use for us. Yes. Whereas the products of our will are not more than their use for us. Right. I mean, I think that's I think that's exactly right. I really don't like the category of appropriateness. O'Donovan, in using the category of appropriateness, is clearly
we will send him an email.
Yeah, well, no, but he's clearly drawing on, you know, kind of medieval conceptions. Yeah. He's actually very gracious by email. I emailed him when I was a no-name undergraduate to ask for writing advice because his writing is so good, and he very promptly sent me multiple pages of advice. It was extraordinary.
Which you promptly forgot, which is why everybody reads O'Donovan and not you. I'm teasing. All right, you were telling us it's a medieval category.
So right. I mean, it's another way of putting the medieval category of fittingness. Yeah, I think, yeah. Right. So when you read, you know, the medievals, they have this category of fittingness, which is to say that, you know, so Thomas will talk about fittingness in the atonement, and he'll say, you know, was it necessary that Christ die on the cross for our sins? This is putting it very sort of crudely. And he says, no, God could have saved us some other way. He could have forgiven our sins some other way, but it is fitting that Christ died, that God saved us in this manner. And the fitting, what's the concept of fittingness, I take it, is to say that there's some kind of natural affinity for two things, right? That two things sort of go together well. So our fallen state and the shape of God's salvation, they just sort of work together well. They sort of cohere properly. And I guess to me that's fine as far as it goes, but if you're trying to do something as load-bearing as think about how humans should relate to reproduction and production, it seems to me that you probably want something a little bit stronger than, well, it could be otherwise, but it just kind of, it seems like it's best this way. Right, you know, well, I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I share your distaste for it in the examples you gave about, say, the incarnation and soteriology and stuff. I agree.
It's funny. I actually like it best there.
Get out of here.
Natural contrarian.
Well, I dislike it there. I think I like it more here because in the kind of thorny world of ethics, I don't know if you held a gun to my head, I would be willing to say that there is never, in all the worlds of possible variables, a time where technological intrusion X might not be appropriate. I can't really think of what it would be, say, on this issue of IVF, for example. It's a helpful category in that sense. Things may be like inappropriate 99% of the time, but you might find the kind of the 1% of the time that kind of some kind of intervention is appropriate. It's a bit like with wisdom and foolishness in scripture, which kind of are somewhat distinct categories from righteousness and foolishness. And we will sometimes, giving people advice, say, well, I don't think that's sinful, but I don't think it's very wise. But the fact is, like, if you're kind of constantly just foolish, then the fool is a sinful category. So, you know, continual inappropriateness may pretty much always probably line up with being sinful. But I just think it gives you a little bit of flexibility for those highly unusual variable times in ethical situations where that's needed.
I think we have to connect his argument about appropriateness with this concept that we're unable to recognize the significance of what we see, that there's a givenness to the reality that we're in and to that which we are, which we have to keep in mind even as we go about our dual activities of begetting and making. And so I think the kind of the requirements for humans to know, to reach out to know, as one of those aspects of our intrinsic vocation is what generates a certain necessity to appeal to appropriateness or fittingness. And we could argue about when you want to do that, but if you argue about that, then you're arguing about appropriateness and fittingness of categories of appropriateness and fittingness.
Can you lay out those steps? I mean, so I'm not saying that, like, I think appropriateness or fittingness as a category, it can never be sort of, can never be, you know, permissible. by any means, or it's just a bad category. Yeah. I just always get nervous about it. So can you slow down in that, Colin, what you were just saying about something about reaching out to know.
Yeah.
It sounded kind of like Aristotle, so I just checked out.
It's always something about reaching out to know on C.
That's right.
You'd agree that we've all agreed that we have a vocation of begetting and a vocation of making, or at least these powers. We do these two things and they're distinct from one another, right? Even though there's some cases where we're allowing, where both things are happening. Okay. Yeah. There's another thing that's not begetting or making, and that's knowing. And he's talking about that, right? As he begins talking about the problem with the technological society is that it begins thinking that the way that it knows stuff is through purely technical means.
Right.
And there's this other way of knowing things, which is necessary, for you to be able to experience reality.
Just Gandalf and Saruman. Gandalf to Saruman. He who breaks things to know them has departed from the path of knowledge.
Right. Saruman, if the only way you can know anything is by, you know, sacrificing it, then you're sort of missing some aspect of it. And so I think that allows for us to sort of talk about the concept of appropriateness. In what way should we know this thing? The Mississippi River, for example. Should we know it as a river? Or should we know it as an energy source that we dam up for the sake of the city downriver from us? And I think that necessarily comes up because we have to think about what form of thinking we're going to use in this case, what's appropriate to it. And so just to defend, I mean, this is at least his thinking, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
If you go to the bottom of page 4,
okay,
he then brings up examples. He says, human life then becomes mechanized because we cannot comprehend what it means when some human activity is natural. And then he gives two examples. Politics becomes controlled by media and mass communication, love by analytical or counseling techniques. So the question we have to ask is, so politics being control, being basically just the activity of someone behind the scenes pulling strings and making everybody do the thing, or, you know, whipping the vote, or, you know, organizing the vote. That's what they say in Union Land, or we're going to organize the vote before the vote, you know. What else could politics be? That's a question he wants you to ask. Or love, right? So love. In love, am I just manipulating my wife to get what I want out of her? Is she just manipulating? Is therapy, you know, when you go to therapy, you know, one of the great critiques of therapy is that you're just sort of going there and paying somebody to manipulate you. You know, you're looking for the best manipulator to get you to manipulate you into doing what you want to do or to not do what you don't want to do. Okay, is love something besides that? Is politics something besides that? How would we know? We'd only know if we have this category of fittingness, because clearly it can be those things. Can it be something else?
Yeah.
Like maybe the river can be something else.
Maybe to thrash it out in the sphere of kind of reproduction.
Which, to Reese's point, the sentence right after the sentence Colin read is, and begetting children become subject to the medical and surgical interventions, which are the theme of this book. So they are very closely related for him.
Yeah. This is... I may be thinking along the wrong lines here, but there are some interventions may even be too strong a word, but uses of technology in the 9-month-long process of begetting a child that we don't oppose. So having a 12-week scan to check on the general health of an unborn child is something I'd... don't think even the most kind of, you know, anti-IVF, anti-technological intervention kind of person would say is wrong or is inappropriate. But say you get the 20-week scan, and at that point you can find out your child's sex. I don't know what you guys have done. We've chosen never to know the sex of our child. I think for me, it actually does feel inappropriate. That is a kind of an access to a level of knowledge that I'm uncomfortable with. Maybe this is just an individual thing, but I don't like what that kind of does to my soul to have that reach into the kind of mysterious hidden place of a woman's womb and to know that fact, which in God's design would normally be a total surprise 9 months later. I don't know that I would tell someone who does choose to learn the sex of their child that it is a sin. I'd make a strong case for it being inappropriate or unwise, and therefore it may be a sin for you.
This is a great example of how slippery the category of fittingness is, right? Because why is it? Well, first, I would just like to say that I found out the sex of both children because I had no idea that either of them was coming until they were here. And then I was like, I've had enough surprises. You know, we're going to find out as much as we can about these little
suckers. Figure out what color to paint the wall.
That's right. So I think it's interesting. So this is one of those, I think this illustrates perfectly why the category fitting is why I dislike it so much for the following reason. You don't think it's inappropriate to know whether your baby has a heartbeat, even though prior to the advent of the kinds of medical technology that you're thinking about, that too would have been part of the sort of mysterious, hidden, you know, dimensions of begetting, right?
They used pre-modern to call it begetting. Quickening, right? That would be what they looked for, which is like kicking and stuff.
Right, yeah. But you wouldn't know that till later. And you wouldn't, and until the baby starts manifesting itself in the external world, right? Which is to say, it starts pushing out of the mother's belly, so to speak. You know, with
or you can do a Mary Tudor and think you're pregnant for a year and actually discover that you've got like stomach cancer. Yeah,
right. So, but I guess to me, this is sort of like one of the instances in which this sort of concept of fittingness can be so slippery, because you have this sense that there's certain knowledge that should be closed off to you. And I think in some cases, I share that sense, not with this particular issue. And yet other knowledge, which seems to be attained by the same means and for relevantly similar ends, which is to say general sort of knowledge of the baby and its progress and sort of more about its nature. And yet in these two divergent cases, you feel very differently. And so I worry that fittingness reduces to a kind of sensibility where you just sort of
it's just how you justify what your taste.
Let me try flipping this on you, Anzi, because we're going to have to wrap up. We've almost made it to the page five. We'll have to come back and do another one on
we haven't even talked about who the libs are yet.
So, do you think that Rhys has a right not to know? Because I think that's tied up with this. He's talking about mass communication. He's talking about, you know, the kind of scientific advance. You can think about the ways that the technological society, you know, can't recognize human freedom to be human in the ways that previous generations were human. You know, I think there's some concerns that are glided over in your argument against fittingness, which I don't think you'd be comfortable with.
This is a really interesting point. I mean, we could sort of raise the stakes a little bit, which would be to say, let's stipulate that there are certain medical interventions, which is true. There are certain medical interventions. Well, maybe a more interesting case would be to say, is there a sort of right not to have prenatal care on the part of a mother, or at least to have sort of like non-medicalized, you know, kind of maybe it's homeopathic, or because obviously women have always had prenatal care.
The Amish.
Right. Or do we have moral obligations to our children in utero that are can technology create new moral obligations such that if I can save the life of my child by taking these preventative sort of measures, I have an obligation to do so. I honestly don't know, because if you say that, yes, you have these moral obligations, then you're essentially saying that there is now a realm of technique that is mandatory. Because we have it, we must use it because it facilitates the health and well-being of another.
Eventually, we have to dam up the Mississippi, eat all the fish, and you know, use all the energy.
If we can get everybody off the earth, then get them off.
If we can stop everybody from starving, we should. Yeah. Right? I mean, like that. But if you say no, then you're essentially suggesting that even though it's within our power to sort of, you know, care more effectively for those, you know, to sort of take actions that are conducive to their health and well-being, you say that it's permissible for the Christian to refuse.
And so I would just argue, this will be my final thing. We probably have to wrap it up pretty soon. Rhys probably has at least another thing. But the category of fittingness is necessary to resolve this conundrum, because you're in a situation where, you know, technical thinking has advanced to such a significant point that the question is forced upon you, and neither option, neither saying like, well, all medical technology is just bad, let's just go back to the Dark Ages. Like, that's ridiculous. Similarly, like, we have to maximize the utility of every atom to produce the greatest quantity of human biomass. Like, that's also insane. You know, this is just not the Christian way of thinking. And so fittingness becomes your last defense, I think, in the technical age, in the technological mindset.
See, I actually think the law...
to save humanity.
I actually think the will of God as my law becomes my last defense. But maybe I'll try to unpack this in future episodes. So
Just to evidence this kind of strength of the logical skeleton underneath O'Donovan's writing here, this is literally the next thing he talks about on chapter 5. So we can say we got to chapter 5. He talks about...
Page 5.
definitely think it's chapter 5. The medical principle of primum non nocere, your first obligation as a doctor is to do nothing, and defending that choice is different from your decision to defend action that you did take. That's just always been how it goes. It's like, yes, I could do something here, but I don't know what ill effects that might have. I don't know what actually is wrong with this person, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas now we have shifted, because of the availability of our technology, to the assumption that if you don't act, having had all this stuff in the medical arsenal, that is immoral. And to kind of bring it down to the realms of reproduction again, we're going through the process of our third child arriving. And
congratulations, Reese.
Thank you. Actually had the 12-week scan today, which is what was on my mind.
That's where you went. Yeah.
But the stuff that you get sent, I don't know what it's like in the States, but the stuff you get sent in the post and from the midwives or whatever about checking for Down syndrome and all the kind of things that are available to do that. You know, some of those tests actually do obviously endanger the fetus if people know the way around this.
Right, we chose not to do those for that reason.
Yeah, those ones we chose not to do. The sense that if you don't avail yourself of that, it's somehow immoral. And actually the midwife who visited my wife at home to kind of do her first sort of assessment and whatever, was, my wife told me, quite subtly pushy on this score, which is thankfully the first time she's had that. We've not chosen with any of our three children to do any of those tests. But even said something when my wife said she wouldn't want to know any of that or do any of the tests, and was slightly kind of flustered by it. And then, said, well, yes, well, you know, obviously you'll be allowed to carry on with the pregnancy. So, my wife was kind of and I think this midwife kind of didn't quite know what she was saying, but there's something in there,
it's
creepy,
deeply based in what O'Donovan's talking about here.
A very quick story similarly. Where I think it was our first kid, they asked us if we wanted all these the same tests that you guys refused, and we refused, and I said, because I'm kind of a outgoing, talkative person, when we were refusing, and my wife was just kind of demurely saying no thank you, and I said, well, we're just gonna be thrilled with whatever baby we get. And the nurse broke down crying and said, I never hear that. It was just like, what in the world? So anyway, yeah, similar. I mean, your story was sort of more sinister, mine is a little bit more tragic, but they're both a little bit concerning. Yeah. And it's around these issues that O'Donovan is talking about.
Yeah. Okay, well, on that note, we've made it to page 5. Gentlemen, congratulations.
The next episode might be chapter 1, part 2.
Maybe. Yeah. On that note,
let's switch. Ourselves to 20 weeks on this.
Let's switch to what we're reading. Actually, real quick, before we switch to what we're reading, just some housekeeping for people. Reese, we decided we're doing this series, but we're not doing it sequentially, right? Is that?
Yeah, we will do a chapter, or half a chapter. We'll decide after this episode's finished. We'll do a Begotten or Made episode every other episode. We hope that everyone is deeply interested in whatever we decide to sit around and spitball about. But it may be that people would prefer us pinging from one eclectic topic to another, so every other episode will be on something different until we get to the end of Begotten or Made. Yeah.
But if you skip the Begotten or Made episodes, you will miss major life updates. Like, you wouldn't have known that Reese and his wife were expecting if you didn't listen to this episode. We should try to coordinate some major life updates every bromance episode. That's right. Yep. All right, Colin, what are you reading these days?
I am reading Cormac McCarthy's The Passenger, and I am reading
it. Is that the new one?
It's the new one, and it comes with
two new ones. He wrote two together, didn't he?
He wrote two together, but I haven't gotten to the second one. You're supposed to read The Passenger first, they say. So I'm a good student of Cormac McCarthy, a huge fan. I've got a whole lecture.
I am too. Is this as good as his prior work? I mean, is this?
You know, the thing about this one is it is as good. It is also him stretching his talent. He's writing from perspectives that you just don't normally see him writing from, including, you know, a young woman and you know, he's sort of getting inside of the mind of a trans person. And he's just like, he also has his stock character, who's like a stoic cowboy-esque dude.
Right, right.
You know, that you're just, you know, you know him for. But it's a little bit funny because it's almost like he ran out of names. And so he just calls this one Western.
Or maybe he's like self-parodying or something, you know? It's like,
Yeah. But it's fantastic. I want to read two quotes, which, you know, one of them I was flamed for by John Wilson for claiming that it was interesting or profound. But he says, "The real trouble doesn't begin in a society until boredom has become its most general feature. Boredom will drive even quiet-minded people down paths they've never imagined." You know, just a beautiful,
so what did John, why did John, friend of the show and very early supporter of Ad Fontes, I owe him a lot.
And will be featured in the next print edition of Ad Fontes.
Oh, wonderful. Oh, yeah. Wonderful. No, I love John. He's a buddy of mine on Twitter, but I think he just thinks that Cormac McCarthy is sort of like a faux intellect who's, you know, offering a dark vision of reality.
Like a faux neo-gothic Southern author or something.
Yeah, like a stoic who's trying to kind of grift on the death of and demise of Christendom or something like that. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but he was kind of like, come on, Colin. This is not...
come on, Colin McCarthy? Really? You know?
No. Yeah. That was sort of it. Okay. The other one that has gotten more traction is probably the most famous quote in it that I've read so far is... beauty makes promises that beauty can't keep. And I like that one in part because I don't think beauty is a transcendental, and I'm on record about that. So beauty makes promises beauty can't keep. That is certainly the human experience of beauty, sort of summarized in a single sentence beautifully by Cormac McCarthy. And remember, because it's beautifully written, it's making you a promise it can't keep.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
How about you? What are you reading, Reese?
Me, I have been reading C.S. Lewis's Miracles for the first time. I'm kind of picking off those.
You're on a Lewis kick.
Yeah, well, I'm picking off those last bits of Lewis that I've not read. Sorry, Aunt C.
It's okay, Reese. There is hope even for such as you.
Well, I was forced.
We'll get
to
you
read
reading better stuff after this. All right.
We're recording this just before Christmas, Miracles was the last text assigned in Joseph Minnick's Approaches to Defending the Faith course at Davenant Hall. Joe, as anyone who knows him will know, is a big Lewis fan and a huge fan of Miracles, Joe's favourite apologetic text. And he's actually did a great lecture, one of our earliest fellows lectures actually, on Lewis's rhetoric in Miracles, which I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and just look for Joe Minnick Davenant Miracles on YouTube and you'll find it. One of the few kind of big Lewis books I've not read, and enjoyed it immensely. Lots of kind of tidbits and stuff that I will remember and squirrel away, but it's just interesting. He's writing to sort of make the idea of the supernatural kind of plausible to the modern, and he writes as a modern, you know, say basically sort of not in a kind of cringy empathetic way, which is one of the things I really liked about it. He's not trying too much to be like, hey, I'm one of you guys, I've been there, you know. He just kind of drops these little moments where it's clear he's looking at modernity from the inside. But like, just the question of miracles and the supernatural is not something that's ever kept me up at night. So it's just not a question I wrestled with. Like, predestination never really bothered me. I never stayed up late wondering if I was elect or whatever and stuff like that.
You know who doesn't worry about whether they're elect, Reese?
Lutherans.
The damned.
Oh, my gosh.
I think those are the two best possible answers to that question.
Well, it's funny. Oh, it's like the reformed position is the people who don't worry about whether they're elect or the people who are elect. And then it turns
that's
out
that's a
reformed
position, Nancy. You know that.
No, yeah. I know. I mean, the sort of like, you know, on the street reformed position, the kind of like layman's, you know, reformed position. Anyway, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't tell my pastor that I don't lie awake. I'm worrying about that at night. Yeah, so as great as it was to trace Lewis's arguments there, and I thought of a friend who, like, okay, I really want to give this book to this particular non-Christian friend. For me, it was kind of like, yeah, cool, like watching him. I don't know, it's like if someone's really into, like, I don't know. Imagine if an American took me to an American football game and kind of explained to me what was going on, and I watched it all unfold. Like, okay, yeah, no, I get it. I see how that works, yeah. And afterwards, I'd still kind of want to go home and watch the cricket. That's kind of what it was like, sort of watching Lewis, you know, deal with these arguments. Yeah.
The cricket.
That's nice.
Why is it the cricket? Why is it just cricket? Do you say the football? Did you misspeak, or is that like a
No, I would. No, it would mean like, it would refer to like a specific instance of that sport taking place. So like if there was a big, like, cup game on TV the night before, the next morning you would walk into work and say, oh, did you watch the football last night? Yeah.
I learned something new every time I talk to you.
And let it be known, actually, big life updates on this. Before we hear about what Auntie's reading, Auntie, what are you drinking?
Oh, I'm drinking. What am I drinking, Reese?
Yorkshire Gold Tea.
Yorkshire Gold Tea. That's right. Yeah. So Reese brought his fancy, you know, English tea to the States, and was like, Americans have no good tea, so I had to bring my own tea. And then he went to like the local Wegmans or whatever, and was like, "Hey, they have my tea here." And so
I
realized
like a tiny
that I
box
get...
for like $9.
But I realized I could get Reese's fancy English tea in the States, and it turns out that it is actually delicious with a much richer, deeper flavor. Yeah,
very good. So,
yeah, it's been nice.
What are you reading?
I have been reading Diogenes Unveiled, which is a kind of collection of the anonymous or pseudonymous, I should say, writings of Father Paul Mankowski, the late Father Paul Mankowski. Who was a mentor to me and really brilliant guy, affiliated at the end of his life with the Lumen Christi Institute, which is at the University of Chicago. He was a brilliant, like, academically, he was a comparative Semiticist from Harvard. So he got his PhD at Harvard, taught comparative Semitics at Rome for many, many years, but his sort of popular level writing, for a variety of reasons, which I've gone into in my the sort of essay that I wrote when he passed, for Mere Orthodoxy, which we can put a link to in the show notes.
Beautiful essay.
Oh, thank you. A lot of his writing, popular level writing, during his life was pseudonymous, and so all of these works have been kind of collected, put into one place. Not all of them, but a fair number have been collected, put into one place, and sold as this book, Diogenes Unveiled. And so it's, you know, it's just a lot of fun. Father Paul was a deeply kind man, and he had the most sort of like biting, kind of, I mean, I'd say wit, but sometimes it was like so harsh that it doesn't really qualify as wit anymore. And so it's just been a lot of fun, getting to read him. It's sort of like, hearing him again. So anyway, that's what I've been reading. I would recommend it. Of course I would. So, and on that note, Reese, what are we spotlighting today?
So we're just into the start of a new year, and people who you Davenant watchers out there will know that just before Christmas we had a big fundraising day. I'm speaking in far into the future. We are recording this on 12/20, big Davenant fundraising day. Rather than kind of spotlight a thing that we're putting out, we wanted to kind of just take a little slot to say thank you to those who donated to the Institute at the end of the year towards that campaign, and actually make it possible for us to do that thing. Colin, this is kind of, you know, big cheese stuff, so I'll kick it over to you as the VP to lend a more weighty thank you than my one.
Absolutely. Right now, as of, you know, it's almost 10 a.m. on the West Coast time on December 20th. We've already got $6,900 of our $20,000 that we're trying to raise. We have generous sort of legacy donors who've pledged $20,000 to match if we can raise $20,000. I'm confident that we're going to be able to get over the finish line by the end of the day, God willing, with all of your help. And if you are listening to this in the future and you didn't give today, obviously we will be raising money next year as well. But we're not asking you for money today. What we really just want to say is thank you so much. The work of the Davenant Institute could not happen if it were not for the partnership of people exactly like yourselves. I always say that my favorite part of listening to NPR is when they have the fundraising drives. That's because NPR's programming is terrible where I live. Hopefully you don't think that the fundraising drives are the best part of what comes out of Davenant. And that's because, you know, your money goes towards so many good, high quality pieces of content that inform you, instruct you, enrich your life, and deepen your faith and your trust in the Lord. So thank you so much for being partners with us, genuinely from the bottom of our heart. It's been the most exciting thing I've done with my life so far outside of getting married and having children. And we couldn't have done it without you.
And to say as well, actually, that your support of Davenant supports Adfontes. Like, you know, we are a publication of the Davenant Institute. We do have paid subscriptions for online access to our quarterly editions and print subscriptions. And we hope one day that is going to be, you know, what keeps Adfontes going, its own paid subscribers. But we are a publication of Davenant, which is a non-profit, and so your support to Davenant directly goes to helping run Adfontes. So thank you, with my senior editor hat on, for those of you who do give. It supports us in our ministry in this bit of the Davenant bailiwick. Yeah.
That's great. I have nothing to say. I have no institutional responsibility anymore.
I have nobody to thank.
I have nobody to thank. All right. Once again, on that note, if you like what you heard today, consider giving us a 5-star review on Spotify or iTunes. And in fact, don't just consider it. You should actually do it. It would be, you know, unfitting for you to do it. No, it would be wrong for you not to do it.
Sinful. In a Kantian sense.
That's right. There is a categorical imperative here, people. Okay,
if everybody else didn't rate podcasts that they like, what state would the world be in?
That's right. Colin, if they didn't like what they heard today, what should they do?
I think they have to go get a PhD from one of the Oxford universities and become the leading living Christian ethicist in the English-speaking world. And once they've done that, and only once they've done that, can they give this a 1-star review. Which means there's one person out there who can do it. It's Oliver O'Donovan, if you're listening, and you thought this was no good, please tell the world and make sure it's by your own name. I would love a bad review by Oliver O'Donovan on the...
We've told everyone that he's very quick to respond to emails, guys, so this is going to go to him.
I was actually going to say, Colin, if they hated the podcast, I think it would be fitting if they still gave us 5 stars because they're generous, kind people.
And because fittingness makes no sense to you.
That's exactly right. All right, and with that, we are the editors. This has been the Adfontes Podcast, and inshallah, we will see you next time.